Dear friends, how are you? I'm Mark Golub. It's always wonderful to be with you again on our JBS series, Gam Yachad, together during COVID-19. The weather's getting warmer. Places throughout the country are beginning to open. But it's still tough, I know, especially if you're living alone. So I hope JBS has been some comfort to you and that you find our program as often interesting and enjoyable. Well, one of the things we've been trying to do on this series is speak to medical experts in the field to learn from them as much about the coronavirus as we possibly can. Even in May, there are still many questions about how the coronavirus is spread, when a medication or vaccine might be available, and whether we should be extending the lockdown or whether it's time to reopen society and restart our economy. Which is why I'm so happy to be joined by a highly respected infectious disease expert at Israel's world-renowned Hadassah Medical Organization in Jerusalem. His name is Dr. Ron Nirpaz. Dr. Nirpaz, thank you so much for giving us some time here on JBS.
Hi, Mark. Thank you very, very much for having me.
Ron, before we even begin talking about the coronavirus, where were you born? Tell us a little bit about your family.
So I was born here in Israel, in the coastal plain, just somewhere between Netanya and Hadera, in one of the villages over there. And just like an Israeli kid, a regular kid, you know, we go to school, primary school, then secondary school, then spending some time at the army, and then back to medical school.
So let's talk now a bit about the virus itself. Ron, is there any question in your mind how the disease is passed from one person to another, or how a person in general contracts the virus?
So, you know, well, one could say yes and no, but I think we fairly know what's going on. We know we contract the virus through something that goes in the air. We can debate whether it's droplets or aerosols, but those are mainly medical terminologies, not necessarily relevant to the simple person. Just about the size of the droplets that infects you, and obviously, if you get the virus through inhaling those tiny droplets or whatever it is into your nose or mouth, or some even suggest through the eyes and eye secretions, the tears that gets into your nasal from inside, then that's how you contract it. Some people get it fairly easy. Some people get it more severe. But that's how we contract it. We don't really know much if we contract a lot or little, whether that makes a difference.
Let me tell you what I, as a lay person, you know, the ordinary person you're talking about, understands. And the reason why I begin here is, and Ron, you should understand this. First of all, anytime you say to me, we don't know, I consider that to be a valid answer. But my concern is the extent to which many people in my audience watching JBS are frightened and are worried that, you know, they're vulnerable to getting the virus. And especially in my demographic, the older demographic, that seems to be the demographic that is most at risk. So it's important for us to have a sense of what's really going on here. My understanding, and then I want you to tell me if you think I'm saying it correctly or incorrectly, is that ultimately, one way one contracts the disease from another person is if one is in close enough proximity that some kind of secretion from the mouth, either a cough or a sneeze, or either if you're too close, just breathing, can bring droplets of that virus into one's own nasal system and that it is a respiratory disease, and that if you inhale it in some way, that is one way you contract the disease. The other way is if you touch something that has a certain amount of the virus on it with your hands, and then you bring your hands to touch your mouth, your nose, or your eyes, you can also bring the virus into your respiratory system. My understanding is those are the only ways you can get the virus. The way you cannot get it, you cannot get the virus if you're simply walking along and somebody across the street is walking along, or you're on a bicycle and you're driving in one way and somebody comes in the other direction and doesn't cough in your face but just passes you on that bicycle, you can't get the disease. I want to know the extent to which you feel I am either saying it accurately or am I oversimplifying it?
I don't think you oversimplified it. You just did quite clear. So I think quite early in the phase of what we learn about this specific disease, medical authorities said that you need to stand in two terms in order to catch the virus. One is to be in a distance which is less than 6 feet, 2 meters. And the other one, you need to be in the proximity of this person for, I'd say, more than 15 minutes. Whether it's 10 or 20, it doesn't really matter. But that's about the time that we need to think about. So if you just pass through a person, then the chances to get a disease is not big. It's relatively small, if not less than small.
Okay.
So, just to simplify things, then I'd say that whatever you said is just about right, and we can even simplify it more by saying less than 6 feet and for more than 15 minutes. If you stand in those terms, then you might catch the virus. Obviously, there's some breaches on those terms, but those are the rough numbers that if we stand on those rough numbers, we are probably safe.
All right, I want to make sure I understand you. Are you telling us that from your knowledge and your experience, what you're hearing from colleagues is, even if you're standing with somebody who has the coronavirus and you're 6 feet or even less, but you're not with that person for longer than 5-10 minutes, it is unlikely that you get the virus?
From what we know and from exposure that we see, many in the medical system, it seems that people that stand with those standards does not necessarily catch the virus. Obviously, if you in extreme close contact with a person, as much as if kissing him, for example, an ophthalmologist that stands just, looking at a patient from a very close distance and it takes 5 minutes, then maybe if it's a closer distance, that the duration is smaller. But most of us do not get into such distances as about to almost nose to nose one with in another. So the chances in such occasions are smaller, and therefore, putting the 6 feet, 15 minutes terms is put you in a safe position. But let us bear in mind, during this epidemic, pandemic, whatever you can call it, the medical administration have suggested another measure to help us protect ourselves. And this measure is of face masks, the surgical face masks. There's now being produced some cloth masks that can be in the standards of surgical face masks. And for those who expend more money on the more sophisticated N95, which are not needed in a daily basis, but and mainly intended for the medical personnel who is doing a very intense procedure with patients in a very close proximity, but just we put all those in a big basket, then the moment that the two people in the interaction use the mask reduce the risk of infection by about 10 times less. It reduces it from 100% if the risk is 100% to 10%. And putting those barriers of different types of social distancing is kind of things that protect us. The other thing that we need to bear in mind, and you mentioned that, is the physical touch of people. The moment that we don't shake hands anymore, as much as it's difficult to change habits, and the more we use alcohol rubs or alcohol gels to clean our hands, or just wash our hands with soap and water, the more we do those things, we protect ourselves and we protect the environment from us. So all those little tricks, which takes time to learn, takes time to practice, are the things that probably will make a difference.
Very interesting, and I love the way you say it. You know, you talked about the touching. There's a lot of question about how an American who is living in an apartment or a home and receives an Amazon delivery, a FedEx delivery, a UPS delivery, letters from the mailman, whether in some way one should be afraid to touch a package that's left at the door, or whether the virus doesn't live that way. What is your advice to people about how they handle packages, letters, whatever, that enters their home?
So I don't want to do much into the technical details of how long the virus survives on a specific type of materials. It's very much technical, but you can just overcome it. Let us assume that you get a very nice package with, I don't know, the new gadget that you want to play with. So all you need to do is just open the package, put the box away, and then wash your hands, and you're good. You're good to go.
Where do you live exactly?
I'm living in Jerusalem.
Okay, you're in Jerusalem.
The western part of it.
All right.
Yeah.
So, Ron, do you ever order takeout food from a restaurant?
No.
And is that for health reasons, or you just don't do it? In other words, I should have asked it, what is your advice to us? Do you think it's smart or less than smart for people to order takeout food from restaurants?
So that's kind of, it's a matter of philosophy or whether you want to protect your environment from the financial distress that comes with it. But when I was before was asked about this specific question, I told the answer that this is a great time for people to start practicing the kitchen. You know, you just order the produce, whatever you want, and then take a good book of cooking and try. The first time you might burn something, the second time you start to enjoy it. And you know, it's a good time for cooking yourself. And in fact, from the infectious disease point of view, you know, I don't want to make trouble to any type of commerce, but from the infectious disease point of view, making your own fresh food from fresh ingredients is probably the best way to avoid infectious agents. It's true for coronavirus, but it's true to some other hobbies of mine or bacterial hobbies of mine, like Listeria and other foodborne pathogens. So generally when I teach a medical student, I tell them, listen, the best way to avoid some kind of foodborne pathogen is just to prepare your fresh food. It takes 5 minutes more and you get the enjoyment of the preparation of and doing something and at the end, you can enjoy it. It's okay to go to restaurants. It's okay to to have a takeaway, everything is just fine. But if you want to minimize the risk, fresh food from fresh produce is your best bet.
I appreciate what you're saying. I just want to push you a touch. I'm thinking about people my age. And by the time you get to be 60 and 70 and 80, there's almost no one who doesn't have what's called some underlying comorbidity. We all have something. And my interest is different than a 40-year-old or a 30-year-old or a 20-year-old. My interest is I don't want this disease under any circumstance. Under any circumstance, I don't want this. So I want you to help me not be sort of, you're a little safer. I want you, doctor, to keep me safe 100%. So when you say, you know, it's okay to take food out. It's not as healthy in the global sense. You'll have fun cooking. And you suggest it in general. I'm not interested in general. I want to know whether Ron is saying to me, Mark, you want to be totally safe? Don't take out food from a restaurant. Is that basically what you're saying, Ron?
You try to put me in a corner. I will try to avoid a corner.
Okay.
I think, you know, the first issue here is that there's no 100% safe. There's no such thing. Even on regular, you know, back just, you know, 5 months ago, when everything was back normal, you would walk on the street and a car could, you know, run you over.
But that's not what we're talking about. Yes, there are dangers in life all the time. That's not what we're concerned with here. We're concerned specifically with how do we stay safe from getting a virus, which at a certain point in age looks like it kills 80% of the people who get it. 80% of the people.
So let's play with the numbers, okay? So the numbers are age numbers and risk numbers. So we, from what we know, then the risk for kids. I'll start with the kids. It's easier, you know. From the age of one and maybe even smaller than that, up to 12, 15, whatever the number is, the risk is extremely minimal, both for catching the virus and transferring the virus to other people. That's a good start. Even for people up to the age of 30, the risks are extremely slim. The chances for people to be more sick exist, but the risks are not big. And then there's the lump of people, the ages of, let's say, 20-something to, I'd say, 100 or whatever it is. And in those range, there's a game. And the game is as such. 40%, even at the elderly age, will be okay and hardly feel the disease. 40%, it's a big number. Then we've got another 40% or a bit more who will have a disease, but it will be nothing more than just a simple flu. That's a big number as well.
Yeah.
So 80-something percent of the people, it will be for them just a very minor event in life. The issue is the rest. Those 15% that from the medical perspective, that we don't want the whole 15% of the whole population to come together. And that makes a lot of difference, because if they come together, then the medical system can't help them handle them. And that's a big issue. That's what happened in Italy, in Northern Italy. That was happened in part of France. That what happened in Belgium and other countries. So when you saturate the medical system, there's a big issue here. if the medical system is not saturated, then playing with the numbers can be of our own benefit. So out of these 15%, only, I'd say, 4% will be in critical condition, meaning the rest 11% will be just fine. So we're talking about 95% of the population who get the virus. Some of them will be admitted to hospital. Most of them will get out of the hospital or not even get to the hospital. That's a big number. And then we get to the more complicated issue. Indeed, in those 4%, the percent of people with more background diseases is higher. Still, it doesn't mean that you see in the other 95% people who are elderly with background diseases that get just the disease with almost nothing. And I'll give you an example. The Diamond Princess, the people who were on the ship, most of them were elderly people. Most of them got out of the disease quite well. There were about, I'd say, a few thousand people over the ship, only 700 got sick. Out of those, very small number succumbed to the disease. Other people were like the Israeli patients that were over there. They were quite, they were above 65, I'd say, in a very good manner. They got a disease. They were hardly noticed that they got anything. They got through it fast and healed nicely. And none of them was, you know, just a healthy, normal person. So we need to bear that in mind. And the more the medical system is not full with patients, the easier it will be to handle the disease.
All right, talk to me about the two medications that are in the air. One is remdesivir. Do you have any sense of whether remdesivir is likely to be efficacious or not?
That's a very complicated question, which I don't think I know the answer for.
Fair enough.
So practically now we have two or three major topics of evidence. One of them is a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine about giving remdesivir without comparator and see how it works. And from what we know from that paper, which was published almost a month ago, then you see that the drug doesn't do any harm, which is a major thing. You know, when you treat patients, you first and foremost, you don't want to create any harm to your patients. But then when you compare the data, you don't really see a major difference from what you know about what's going on with the disease. So you need to have comparative studies in which you compare the drug you're looking at to a placebo or a different drug. And then there's a study came out at The Lancet, I think a week back, that suggested that remdesivir doesn't do much. It might do something, but doesn't do much. And there's the statement by Anthony Fauci when he was with President Trump that suggested that the NIH-sponsored study was practically halted before time, because they saw some reduction in recovery time between patients who got the remdesivir and patients who didn't. Still, it didn't prevent death. So obviously, the other study, the study of the NIH, we need to see the data. We need to read it carefully to understand what's going on over there. One of the major tools that we follow up on medical literature now is apparently Twitter, and you can learn from Twitter a lot of things about how people, you know, respond to medical information, and it's interesting because it's a change, and people do comment, you know, very prominent people who are knowledgeable just post their opinion over there, and you can learn from over there that there's practically now a big debate about whether remdesivir really makes a difference or not. But still, I haven't seen the data from the NIH study, and I understand that there's another or at least two other studies going on. And I think at the end we'll know something. Right now, it's too early to say anything. Nevertheless, remdesivir does not do harm, so that's fine.
I
And indeed,
understand.
the FDA gave this authorization of use, which enables people to use it not on a very strict level, but to have an access to the drug. And if indeed it does anything and improve patients' life, then that's a major issue.
Okay. And there was a lot of controversy in America over hydroxychloroquine. What's your sense of that medication?
So the debates with hydroxychloroquine is extremely major one. It started from a very shaky evidence. There was a note from the Chinese that they put it into their standard of care without seeing the evidence. And there's the information that came out from Marseille about the trial with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin that caused a big hype. And then people start opposing, and we started to see some side effects of the use of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. And I think that's an issue that caused some kind of a break of using the drugs. But from what you see in the clinic, it seems that indeed there's something in this medication that makes a difference. Still, it's just an impression. It's not worth until you compare it to none or something. And indeed, there's a couple of very large studies, one of them in the USA, the other one in Europe, that should give us an answer, hopefully in a due time, that we could gain some information out of it. In my view, hydroxychloroquine, when used on the right dosages, doesn't do any harm. And that's the major issue.
Interesting.
Hopefully it does something. And maybe at the end, maybe somebody is thinking about that. Just a combination of drugs will make the difference. Because we know from other viral diseases, in some cases, what you need is not just one medication, but rather a combination of two medications or more to create a big difference.
By the way, are either of those drugs being used now in Hadassah Hospital?
So hydroxychloroquine is in our protocols, and we enable the use of it to patients who are not extremely easy patient, but rather getting into the moderate phase of disease. So we, based on review of the data, we think that at this specific stage, there's some evidence to suggest some clinical improvement, nothing more than that, that can justify the use of it. Remdesivir is not really available in Israel. It is available on a small compassionate use study sponsored by the Ministry of Health in two or three hospitals. And just tomorrow, we're going to have some initiation study of the Solidarity trial, the WHO trial, that might give access to this drug via this trial, but hopefully we will not use it in Israel since luckily the number of cases in Israel is rapidly going down, and we are now at about 30 new cases per day, nothing more than that.
Yes, by the
So
way, you know, Ron, it is remarkable. Israel, as you and I are speaking right now, is only 33rd on the global list in terms of their ranking of the number of deaths per million people. And the higher the number, the worse it is. So for Israel to be 33rd, the United States, for example, is 10th on the list, which on the one hand, Ron, is better than most Americans imagine that Israel, that America is. There are nine other countries with a worse death rate than America, and the only European country that's better than America is Germany. All the other European countries have a higher death rate than the United States. But Israel's death rate seems to be very, very low. And I wonder if you have any sense why that's so.
So I think the major issue in Israel is the massive lockdown that been implemented in Israel quite early. You know, flights were stopped back at February, and that's a major issue. The other issue is medical care, obviously. And the second, the third issue is number of patients that were diagnosed with the disease. The ability to diagnose most of the patient put a context into the number of death. If, for example, we look at the UK, over there, they just measure the severe and critical cases. So they don't measure the mild and moderate cases. So that makes a big difference on the proportion of dying people out of the total people reported. So that's one issue. The more you know about the population, the less death rate you will have reported. And I think in a way we are similar in that sense to Germany. We have more than 200 deaths in Israel, and that's not a nice thing, but overall then the death rate is in the anticipated limits. It's 200 and something out of 16,000 patients.
And by the way, I'm glad you said that. Israel has 26 deaths per million people, and you have something over 200. But even 200 deaths is every death is horrible. No one, I don't even have to say that. Every death is tragic for any family. And it's not about percent. It's 100% if it's somebody you love. But in terms of social policy and looking at the coronavirus in a broader sense, that Israel only has 200 deaths is remarkable.
That's true, and it's good. And I think we're lucky in the sense that the medical system was not saturated. And when the medical system is not saturated, your chances to give proper help to your patients are better. You know, I'll tell you a story about it. You know, I'm in a big hospital in Israel, a bit more than 1,000 beds. At the peak of disease, we had 100 patients of coronavirus at our hospital. I'd say that out of those, 25 were in critical condition. A few weeks back, to the request of one of my colleagues, I called the guys in New York, one of the hospitals over there, just to discuss the case of their grandmother, who is 93. I'm living in New York, and just to get an appreciation what's going on in that hospital. So it was a large hospital, 2,700 beds, which is a fairly large hospital. Still at that hospital, at that time point, there were 1,400 coronavirus patients. Of those 200 were ventilated. There is no way when you put those number in such a hospital that it will not pay back. But in a way, it's a payback. You'll get a payback with mortality. And I spoke with another colleague from California. He was working in a hospital in which physicians went to New York just to help over there. And the stories that they tell, that they had 27 codes in a shift out of which none survived. So when the system is extremely saturated, and I think this is the major issue, the moment that the system is not saturated, we're good.
Very interesting.
The moment that you get into the saturation, then that's the time that people start to die.
Okay. You know, everybody's looking for and talking about and hoping for a vaccine. In early April, Ron, Israel's Migal Research Institute announced that it had developed a vaccine for COVID-19 that worked in poultry, and it said that in a matter of months, it would have an oral vaccine for human beings. What do you know of Miguel's research, and do you have any sense as to whether they're anywhere near developing a human vaccine?
Those are really encouraging news that I read in the media, almost similar to you. But we need to remember that coronaviruses in domestic animals, poultry and others, are tricky viruses. Over there, they vaccinate, for example, in cattle. They vaccinate the cattle every year for that. Same goes with poultry, but poultry life cycles are shorter. So I hope really that something going over there. I know that they partnered with a few big pharma for that, and hopefully something will get out of it. They got the platform. Hopefully this platform will work on humans as well. It's not just good for poultry. If indeed that is the case, then first phase studies should start fairly soon. We know now that there's like three, four couple of first phase studies going on, one in the States, and I think there's a couple more going around. I'm not sure that the Miguel group is going to start with humans, but since they working together with some of the big pharma, I'd assume that we'll start some trials soon.
Isn't that encouraging news?
I'd like to be on the optimistic side, in which that everything that happens before a year from now is big news. So you know, I like to be surprised for the good. Okay. The reality with developments of drugs and vaccines that takes time.
Yes.
Even when you're on the verge of having first, then it's still, you need to go through a phase one experiment, then phase two, then phase three. And this process takes time. Putting all those into 1 year is a major task. It's not a simple task. And then to get approval for that, indeed, this is a major task. Hopefully, it will be soon. But I think realistically saying, then in a year from now, if we'll have a vaccine, we're extremely lucky.
I want to make sure I understand you. Are you saying you hope that within a year we have a vaccine, or are you saying you believe in a year we'll have a vaccine?
It's a hope. It's not a belief. You know, it's not knowledge, unfortunately. You can play with the term, I hope. Having the vaccine a year from now is very fast, therefore it's a hope.
One other question in terms of how people deal with this disease themselves and try to protect themselves from it. There's a lot of talk in America now about oximeters, which are things that you put on your finger, and it's a little gadget. And what it does is it measures the amount of oxygen in your blood. And that is supposed to be an indicator, an early indicator, even before one has symptoms, of whether one has incipient coronavirus. If the oxygen in the blood goes below a certain level, it is an indication that one might have, or one does have, coronavirus. Is this being used, are oximeters being used in Israel by ordinary households? And what's your advice about, for our audience, should every household have an oximeter?
They're not good indicators for having the beginning of disease with coronavirus. You know, for the people who are mildly symptomatic, or, you know, for the 80% of the population, they're not in need. They're mainly in need for the rest, you know, the 15% or 20%. And in those patients, the saturation meter, if the saturation goes below 93%, just puts you in what we call the meter of severity of disease. This is rather a very rough measurement. Obviously, if you go below 90, that means that you need to be at the hospital, not at home. I had a couple of patients whom I knew before, and they were in a more complicated setting than Israel. And to those, I suggested just go get a saturation meter and put me twice a day, and just to make reassure them that everything is just about fine, or whether they need to go to seek medical attention and not just stay at home. Saturation meter, a very good measurement for a rough estimate of the severity of disease. But when you start to see something over there, that means that you need to go to have a medical observation, to be admitted to a hospital,
I understand,
and to have a better.
So it sounds to me like you're saying it isn't critical to have an oximeter, but it can't hurt to have one.
Of course, of course. You know, I think, you know, a few of the people already have those within this, the meters that they use for sports, like pitches and stuff. They have a saturation meter built within, so you can follow, use those, and many people have access to those, and you can buy for $20 or something, just a very small saturation meter, and have one at home. It's very nice. It's just a nice gadget to play with. So for all the people who love gadgets, this is just another that you have.
All right. The last area I want to discuss with you has to do with the lockdown. And you mentioned that you think that's one of the reasons why Israel was so successful. At one point, Ron, the World Health Organization was predicting that 3.4% of the world's population was going to contract the virus. That number has been revised dramatically, so that now it's 0.1, 0.2%. I mean, it's leagues, it's a different league. And one of the questions that's being raised is the lower rate that we are now seeing, is it really the result of our countries locking down, your countries locking down? And one of the things I wanted to know from you was, and I don't know if you'll remember, do you remember when you first learned about the threat of the coronavirus?
So, yes, in fact, the first time I've learned it was the 31st of December. There's some kind of respiratory disease in China coming on and going on, and that's the first time, and that's just like a ringing a bell.
At that point, on December 31st, did you think to yourself, the government should shut down every airport and we should start sending people to be at home?
Obviously not.
when does that happen, Ron?
So I think it's about February when you start to see that the numbers are rising up and things are changing. And then you realize that maybe air travel need to be done a bit differently.
I almost understand. I'm pushing you to understand when you realized that it wasn't a problem in China. It was a problem that was going to devastate the state of Israel as it has devastated every other country. And the best way to avoid total devastation was to tell people they had to stay at home and basically close down society and close down the economy and close down the airport. At what point, Ron, do you say to yourself, oh my goodness?
So I think back in February, the sense that if you read the literature, you would understand what's going on, what is the mortality rate, and how should be going on. Although I knew to say it at that time, I couldn't see the lockdowns coming in such mass gatherings.
You would
not. I'll tell you something more.
You would not.
No, there's so saying something and there's understanding something. I knew what to say. It was hard to understand. But I'll tell you another story. When I was in Japan, I didn't have too much time. But when I had a free time, I went to one of the big electronic stores over there. At the entrance of the store, there was all the memorabilia section for the Japan Olympics. So I went to this section and I bought as much as memorabilia as I can. And then when I came home, I told my kids, listen, guys, here is memorabilia for the Olympics that is not going to be taking place. This is something rare. Cherish that.
That's a great story.
And that was February.
Okay. My point is, and I think you're helping me make it, that in some way, this virus snuck up on everyone, including very smart people in the state of Israel and very smart people here in the United States. That even though we saw it in China, the understanding of its pandemic capabilities were not recognized by anybody, not by politicians, not by world leaders, not by the medical profession. And I want you to, to what extent do you think I'm right? Or somehow, were there a lot of people smarter than you who were already scared to death? You just didn't know it.
So I'd say the countries that got 17 or 18 years back understood what's going on and they were well prepared. Taiwan and Hong Kong got it right, and they got it right quite early. And I think even the WHO got it right, and they tried to convey the messages to all the Western part and the rest of the world. And I think many countries heard the music, but they felt as if it's a dissonant music, but it was not. This was just the right tune, but we were not ready to perceive it. It's like listening to a 20th century music after you're regular to use to listen to Baroque. It's a big leap, but if you're a musician, then you understand how it's connected.
Okay,
so
but you're telling me even smart doctors in Israel, like you, didn't hear the right music.
We heard the music, but it's hard to understand when the swell, the big wave is going to collapse on you. You know, so I knew what to know. I knew how to tell people, how to prepare people, but to understand that it's going to be a major lockdown, that we're going to go in the streets with masks, and this is going to change our lives in a way that we didn't even see it coming. You know, avoid air traveling for a year or so. Avoid conferences, medicals, changing the way that we communicate with people. Those are major issues. You can't really see all the details. You can understand that this is a major issue. But back in February, would I know that when I go out of my house, I'll put a mask wandering around? I wouldn't do my consultation in Cyprus, for which I consult over there every month for the last 8 years or so. Many of my routines are going to change in a way that I can't even see now when they're going to be back the way they were before. So you don't see all the details. You can understand the big picture, but you don't see the whole details. And I think the little details of changing our lives is the major issue that we're now facing.
So what is your position now on a country's unlocking? At what point would you like to see Israel begin to loosen its restrictions? And what advice do you have for America? And many Americans are saying there's a balance. The economy has been so severely damaged. The rate of unemployment has skyrocketed in a way that we have never seen even in the depression of the 1920s. So that there's a lot of angst about when we allow people to go back into society, even if they're wearing masks and they're social distancing. People want the society to begin. They want the economy to begin. And at the same time, there's a worry that if we let people back out into the streets, the epidemic will still be there. And as you said, the most important thing is not to overwhelm the health system or to not overwhelm any individual hospital. So there's this tension and this dilemma. So, Ron, I guess this is the last question I'm going to ask you. Where do you stand on the question of at what point in the process do you believe there should be a relaxation and that people who are certainly 40 years or younger, who have a very, very low risk of getting a disease that will kill them, and you've made that point, people certainly 40 years and younger should be allowed back into society, back into the workforce, and people who are 60, 70, or 80, they should remain put. But how do you view that? And, you know, when you talk about this with your wife, what conclusions do you reach?
So I have plenty of things to say here. So the first and foremost, Israel's already started the unlockdown a week back. And, you know, school started this Sunday in Israel. The week starts on Sunday. So schools started to open this Sunday, taking into account that the kids have a really low risk for disease. So in Israel, the process already started. Shops on the streets already start to open. Malls will open partially this Thursday. So we are already in the process of opening the country and starting to make things over.
But are you comfortable with that?
The answer for that is yes. At least with part of it, I'm pretty comfortable with it because it's important. Because when you started to say about economics, I think it's like a pole, a triangle with three poles. One of them is economics. The other is medicine. The third one is psychology. You know, the distress that being locked down or economically causing you is also both mortality and very stressful behavior, both on kids and poverty and things like this. And for that reason, I think using the tension between the three poles of this situation is quite important. And the balance is in between the three. And the other issue is whether your government has decision what it's going for, mitigation, meaning reducing the amount of disease and that's it, or containing the disease and preventing from new cases. Those are two different situations. And if you go for mitigation, then the parameters they look at, and we've done some work on that, colleagues who are physicists at the Hebrew University and epidemiologists, And we came out into the conclusion that you need to draw a line in which you think that your medical system can cope with the tension that COVID-19 poses on it. And you can create upper and lower limits for you know, opening and system and making sure that you maintain the same level of tension in the medical system. And as long as you do that and you enable the medical system to work on regular cases, as well as COVID-19, without breaking the system, that's probably your best way to go and enabling you to open both economics and lockdowns and enabling people to get back to life as much as possible, keeping social distancing and protection from each other. And we need to bear in mind that we are humans, we are social creatures, we are social, and if we not socialize, it's not going to be good for us. That's part of the deal. We need to remember that. And that's part of our health as well. It's not just, you know, having COVID-19, yes or no. We need to interact with each other. If you don't do that, that's a major issue as well. So it's balancing between all those three poles that will lead us as a society from one point to another.
It has been so wonderful to talk to you, Ron. You are an incredible physician with a very big heart, and you're wise. And I appreciate the extent to which your answers to me were thoughtful and nuanced. And you were so patient with me. You let me ask you any question I could possibly ask. And it has been wonderful to meet you on Zoom, on JBS. I wish you kol tuv v'hatzlacha, and I wish that you always stay safe, stay well, and when this entire nonsense is over, you and I get a chance to meet in person. Thank you very, very much, Ron.
With pleasure. It was a pleasure to be here. The same to you, and enjoy.
Thank you, my friend. Litot. Bye-bye.
Litot. Bye-bye.
The insights of Dr. Ron Nirpaz, an infectious disease expert at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, a lovely, lovely man. I hope you found some of his answers and his take on the coronavirus interesting and helpful, and that you learned something from him. That's all the time we have for this edition of Gam Yachad, Together During COVID-19. It's always wonderful to be with you, my friends. Remember, if you want to share any thoughts you have to my discussion with Dr. Nirpaz, you can always email me at rabbigolub@jbstv.org. My thanks as always to our director, Sloan Copeland, and to the producer of this edition of Gam Yachad, Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Stay safe and be well, my friends.